This is Radio Times. I'm Artie Moss-Cohen. Our guest is Bruce Eric Kaplan, whose crudely drawn and darkly funny cartoons are a popular feature of The New Yorker and include his initials BEK in large block letters in the corner. The magazine rejected his work when he first started out as a cartoonist. He sent 10 cartoons a week for several years before the editor finally said, yes. Kaplan has written and illustrated a touching, frank, and humorous memoir, I Was a Child, about growing up in Maplewood, New Jersey, in a tense and anxious household. He watched lots of television. In fact, he writes that he wanted to crawl in the TV set and stay there permanently when he was a kid. And he adds that in a way he did, because now he works in TV, including shows 6 Feet Under, Girls, and Seinfeld. Eric Bruce Kaplan joins us on Radio Times to talk about growing up and his varied career. And nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks. And it's Bruce Eric Kaplan.
Bruce Eric Kaplan.
Yep.
Did I do that wrong? Bruce Eric Kaplan.
Yep.
Okay.
Yep.
Okay. You kind of, I wasn't sure when I said crudely drawn. I wasn't sure about that. And I heard you go, ugh.
I didn't. I registered it. I don't think I made a noise. I just wondered if it was official. Like, have the forces, has the New York Times said officially, my drawings are crude? I thought they were simple.
Oh.
But I'll take crude.
Well, I mean
in the best possible way.
As best possible way. Well, I'd love to have you read from the very beginning of your book. That
Absolutely.
Would be great.
Let me get to it.
Sure.
I was a child, but I wasn't very good at it. I'm not sure why. I think a lot of us are born waiting to be adults. I know I was. I just sat there waiting. This is that story. My mother went into labor with me at the 1964 World's Fair, which was in Queens, New York. Every time I fly into JFK and take a cab to Manhattan, I look out the window at the old fairgrounds and I think, that's where I began. I was taken home to 20 Summer Avenue in Maplewood, New Jersey. On the front porch was a gray box, meant for milk bottle delivery and pickup. When I was a baby, a milkman would come by once a week to pick up the old bottles and replace them with new ones. Then, of course, he stopped coming when all the milkmen stopped coming. That box stayed on the front porch for the next 4 decades, empty. When something was put somewhere at my parents' house, it stayed there, long after it broke, or no longer served a purpose, or just wasn't used anymore for whatever reason. I have 2 brothers, Michael and Andrew, 7 and 4 years older. I have no idea how they felt about me showing up. I do know that very early on, I had the sensation that everyone was a lot bigger and they could hurt me.
And that's Bruce Eric Kaplan reading from the very beginning of his memoir, which I have to say I thoroughly enjoyed and appreciated that it was so that I could read it in an hour. And it's illustrated.
Yes. It's a quick read.
It is a quick read. What made you want to write it?
I didn't know that I wanted to write it. I had a meeting at a publishing company in New York, and I went in to talk about doing a book. I thought of something similar to my Twitter feed, which is drawings and observations. So I sat down in their office, and I started talking about the Twitter feed and how I had started to do it when my father was dying, and I was having a hard time focusing on being present, and this was a way to be present. And I had the meeting about 4 months after my father actually died. So I started talking about my father and my childhood and both my parents and what it was like growing up in my house and how I loved TV and how that was a big part of my childhood. And I just kept talking. And finally, the meeting, you know, went on for a long time, over an hour. And at the end of it, they were like, this is great. We've got the book.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah. And so I called my agent, you know, immediately on the sidewalk outside their building. I was like, I think I sold them this book. I have no idea what it is. It's apparently about
now
my
I
childhood.
Now I have to write it, right?
Yeah. Well, I always feel that way anytime I sell something. It's like, oh, my God, why did I do that? Now I have to actually do it.
Well, in that reading, you said, you know, you always felt that somebody or somebody was going to hurt you.
Yeah.
Were you bullied as a kid? I mean, were you...
No, you know, the normal stuff. I mean, you know, 2 older brothers, you know, my oldest brother, you know, tried to kill me all the time. But I'm
because he's your older brother?
Yeah, I mean, you know, that's the par for the course, I hear. Both of them are great guys, and they're not bullies either.
Right,
one. Yeah.
Right. But you just, I mean, were you a fearful kid, or that's just sort of what it is to be the youngest of 3 boys, and, you know, things are going to happen?
It's probably both. I think everyone in my house I think, was fearful. I mean, that was instilled in us, you know, and I, you know, my grandparents were fearful. I didn't know anyone in any relatives who weren't fearful. You know, that was a way to tell if someone was actually related to you.
Your mom, as you say, I mean, she seemed like an overwhelmed mom.
Yeah.
She had three boys.
Right.
And you have a wonderful description. At the end of her day, she would sit and smoke a cigarette.
Right. Read a book in the living room and smoke a Salem Light and, you know, just
kind of relax for the day.
Just finally have a moment of peace.
But did you feel you had to tiptoe around the house for fear of upsetting her or getting her going?
I'm thinking. I do think that I was aware that if I was upset, she would be even more upset. And so at an early age, I quickly learned to, like, I'm not going to be upset anymore because it's not worth the trouble of, like, freaking her out and having her cry. So I guess if you call that tiptoeing, I guess you're nodding. So I guess that was tiptoeing.
Well, I nod a lot, apparently. And your dad was a math textbook editor.
Correct.
And went to New York, what, every day? Or took the train somewhere every day?
We lived in a suburb in New Jersey, and he took the train to New York every day. Yeah.
Did he like his job?
Mm.
Can you tell?
I think he liked – I'm going to revise that. No, he did not like his job. I think he had wanted to be a writer, a creative writer, like fiction or television, actually. And this was what he did once he had a family and – needed to support them.
Mm. You say this book is dedicated. This book is for my parents who tried.
Mm-hmm.
And you can take it so many different ways. I mean,
let's hear. How did you take it?
Well, they tried, but they didn't succeed. That's one way. They tried, but they weren't good enough. They tried and they did the best that they could.
I just pointed that.
That
was what I meant by
right.
They tried. The book is a hopefully honest account of my parents and my childhood from my point of view. And there was some – I grew up in a certain time, as we were just talking about before the show began,
right.
Where people of that generation, my parents' generation, you know, the ones before it, they had a different relationship with emotions and authenticity than it seems like we do today. And so my parents were doing the best they could given the families they grew up in and the time that they lived in. And that's what I mean by they tried. And I do – the book is meant as a tribute to them because it's great that they tried. It's great that we all try. It's not like, you know, I'm a parent now and it's not like I'm succeeding to the degree that I would like to in any way, shape, or form. I'm just trying.
Well, and you also describe, and there's some, I mean, your life and my life pretty different, but nonetheless, there were certain things that I recognized mm-hmm. about. For instance, you said your mom had the same haircut for her entire life.
Mm-hmm.
And that, I mean, I don't think that's true of parents these days. You know, people are trying out different looks.
Right.
But there was something about perhaps that generation where you kind of stuck with what you had.
Right. Absolutely. I mean, I saw pictures of her in college, her wedding album, up until the day she died in the hospital, it was the exact same haircut, same length, same shape, same amount of hair. Oh, I mean, at the end, you know, the hair is going. But
right. And things didn't change. I mean, furniture didn't change in your house either. Things stayed the same.
Right. It was like as if something was there, it was as if God put it there. You know what I mean? It wasn't
You don't
moving.
Tamper,
yeah,
right?
Exactly. That was the attitude, apparently. Like, you know, if something broke, that was that. You know, I read the passage about the milk bottle. So,
indeed. And it's funny because even today, sometimes walking around neighborhoods, and I don't think people get milk delivered the way they did back in the 50s and 60s.
Well, I don't think any. Do they still exist?
I don't know, but you see those milk containers on people's porches. So
really?
It's so interesting. Kind of a throwback.
But you don't see the milk van
but
coming.
But you don't see the milk
so
van
So obviously
coming.
It's like a decorative thing.
Yeah.
But it's
like
actually
that.
They similar. You mean so it could be someone like my parents because my father died a couple of years ago. Well,
so it
could be someone who literally the milkman was coming in 1960 something.
Yeah. You watch a lot of TV. I grew up in a house where we were allowed to watch half an hour a week, which seemed, you know, just like a starvation diet.
I'm sure.
When it comes to
TV. I would have died.
But you watch a lot of TV.
Yeah, it was my lifeline.
How
I mean,
so?
The TV was reality to me. My reality, what was going on outside the TV was crazy to me. Like, I couldn't understand any of it. It seemed very devoid of emotion and sort of just, I didn't understand what was happening. Whereas in TV, everything was very clear and people were living their lives and they were having like an amazing time. That, you know, I loved old movies. I loved sitcoms. I loved, you know, reruns of shows in the morning. I love Get Smart. I Dream a Genie, that kind of stuff. And it was just very full of life. And I talk about this in the book, like everyone was expressing themselves in these TV shows. Like if someone was upset, they yelled. And if someone was happy, they laughed. And it was all very clear, the emotions, in a way that were not mm-hmm. in my house. So, I soaked that in.
I mean, was it that your parents didn't show emotions or?
They just...
They denied.
Yeah, denied. Like, you know, my father would be upset and he would, I'd say, like, are you angry? And he'd say, I'm not angry. And my mother would be, I'd say to my mother, like, you seem tense. And she's like, I'm not tense. You know, and even for me, if this is in the book, if I said I was angry, my father would say, you're not angry.
Oh.
You know, so even my emotions were negated.
You write in the book, emotions are a confusing thing for me and still are. I mean, they were a confusing thing
for you. I'm hoping
you
can explain them.
I'm not going to go there. But there was something about the emotions on TV that just seemed so real and
it was all very
obvious.
Direct. You know, even when Lucy wasn't being direct with Desi, she was being direct with Ethel. She would say, like, I'm upset. He's doing this. I want to go on stage. Like everyone's motives and goals and hopes and dreams were out there, you know.
Did you watch TV with your family?
Sure. I watched Here's Lucy when I was little.
And it seems like that was a favorite.
With my dad. What else did – my dad loved Family. I remember we watched Family. You know what Family is?
Vaguely.
Christy McNichol, Seda Thompson.
It was I only had half an hour a week.
It was like a precursor to Parenthood or 30-something. It was like an hour drama about a family in Pasadena and their troubles, and Meredith Baxter Burney was the older sister. you should look it up. That was a great one. We watched The Waltons together. That was good. You know, the whole Saturday night CBS, that was a big night for us. Right. You know, Mary Tyler Moore, Bob Newhart, Carol Burnett.
And did you think, I want to career in TV somehow?
I didn't think that I wasn't aware of wanting to work in TV. I was aware of wanting to crawl in the TV.
And like, you write that. Yeah.
That the TV was so important to me that I just, if I had, could have gone inside of it, I would have. And, you know, now I, in retrospect, now become having, after I became a TV writer, I realized, I guess I did it, you know, because when you're on the sets of these TV shows that I work on, you've actually done it. You've crawled inside the TV set.
Let's take a very short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. Our guest is Bruce Eric Kaplan and we're talking about his memoir. It's called I Was a Child. It's about growing up in Maplewood, New Jersey with his parents and his two brothers. He's also a writer and producer, has worked on shows including Seinfeld, 6 Feet Under, and Girls. We're going to take a very short break and then get back to our conversation. To join us, you can call us at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. I should add that he's also a cartoonist for The New Yorker, and you would recognize his work with the BEK, the large block letters in the corner of the cartoon. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, talking with Bruce Eric Kaplan about his new memoir titled I Was a Child. I'd love to have you actually read another section from the book, and this is Dinner at the Kaplan Household.
All right. Okay, here goes. Hold on. Let me get water for this
Okay,
one.
Fair enough. Live
radio. All right. Every dinner at our house began the same way. We were called to come in. Then we all sat at the table while my mother scurried around doing some last-minute things to get the food ready to bring to the table. Just as she would bring what seemed to be the last dish and sit down, she would leap up, remembering one more thing, like a small dish of mayonnaise. The four of us would sit there waiting. The rule was no one was allowed to serve themselves until everyone was seated at the table. "Where's Mom?" my father would say in a booming voice over and over again. "Where's Mom?" She was only a few feet away, dumping mayonnaise into a dish in front of his eyes, but still he kept saying, "Where's Mom?" Something always became increasingly aggressive about his, "Where's Mom?" I don't remember the three of us ever answering his rhetorical question. I'm not sure I have ever understood why rhetorical questions exist, why people say them, or why there is a name for them, they should be outlawed. Once my brother Michael made the mistake of helping himself to a piece of food before my mother had sat down for the last time. Maybe he couldn't help himself because it was steak, a meat we were served rarely. Everyone acted like steak was gold. Maybe they still do. In any case, while my father was saying, "Where's Mom?" Michael put the piece of steak on his plate. My father, quicker than I had ever seen him move, snatched it up in a fit of anger and threw it across the room toward the little white plastic garbage can that lived in front of the dishwasher. He missed. Everyone was very upset about the whole incident. Most upset were my father, Michael, and my mother, who instantly broke into tears. My brother is disputing that. One of my brothers said he doesn't remember her breaking into tears.
Oh, but he remembers everything else leading up to that.
The incident happened. It's just I remember the tears and he doesn't. It's memory.
Yeah, it is memory. It is memory. I like that scene only because the sort of ritual of it, but it does have this sort of dark undertone to it as well, if I can put it that way.
Sure. I don't know. There was something dark and wonderful about it.
Yeah. Where's Mom, right?
Yeah.
A little menacing there.
It was, as I said, my parents were doing the best they could. And that was his way of dealing with his upset that my mother was scurrying around, I guess.
Yeah. You know, it's so funny because you're 50, so you grew up in, what, the 60s?
Yeah, born in 64.
And you describe what it's like to live in a house that has one telephone with a cord as if it's kind of the olden days when there was just that single telephone and the cord would only go so far, which meant you couldn't be wandering from room to room.
No, not at all. I remember exactly how to stand so I could, take the phone that was in the kitchen and answer it. I could get up from the den watching TV, go answer the phone, and then go stand in the dining room because the cord could stretched around a door into the dining room where I had a view of the TV in the den and I could keep watching the program because it was the olden days, which it was. That was my only chance to see the program. Right. I couldn't pause it.
Right.
It wasn't, if I didn't see it then, it was gone. So it's like you'd miss the moment if you're in the middle of a show.
Your book also is a really poignant description of both of your parents dying. Your mother gets cancer. It sounds like she died pretty quickly. And you describe sort of watching this woman, your mother, sort of wither away.
Yeah, both my parents died of cancer. My mother struggled with lung cancer for a couple of years, but then the last 6 weeks of her life, she went to the emergency room because she had some stomach pains, and then she just never left the hospital.
Yeah.
There was the cancer had spread. It was all over, and it was 6 weeks in the hospital. And she lay in a bed, and she slowly devolved, started to decompose, actually, while still being alive, which is actually the same thing that happened with my father. He managed prostate cancer for years and years, fell down, went to the hospital. He had broken his femur, and then we learned he had bone cancer. And they said he's got about 6 months, which it was about 6 months. And it was very similar to my mother, just watched him disintegrate.
But you described that they sort of fought to live.
They clung.
To the
bitter
end.
They were not going anywhere. They just were really, they were good at clinging. And they really were not, they didn't want to go.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's another generation, especially both my parents were religious, but I'm not sure they believed in an afterlife.
You miss them?
Yeah.
Does this book sort of help you remember them or remember your childhood with them?
It did. I mean, I wrote it when I was still just a few months after my father died, and it was really a comfort every day to work on it because they were alive and they were healthy and they were young.
Mm.
And it was all very soothing, although at the end of each day when I would stop working, I would just look up and they'd be dead. It was as if I was getting a phone call every single day that I worked on this book, all through the process, even into editing it. When I was working at the publishers with the design of the book and we'd be going through it, I'd be in it, but then I'd look up at 4 o'clock when I was leaving and they'd be talking to me And I was, one day I was just like, I can't talk. Yeah. And I can't talk because I was just reliving it again. So it was both soothing and not soothing.
Yeah. Yeah. And now, I mean, you've written a book about your parents, so the rest of us get to judge them or have opinions about them.
Right.
Are you comfortable with that?
Sure. I don't mind people's opinions. I mean, they're just your opinions. I think I know more than you guys do.
I'm sure you do.
So,
Fair enough.
You can have your opinion.
When did you start cartooning? And did you, were you a drawer as a kid?
Yeah, I always doodled, always drew while I was watching TV or talking on the phone. And I made little fake comics when I was a kid. But it was all – I didn't think I would grow up to be a cartoonist. I ended up becoming one because I was out in Los Angeles trying to be a TV writer or a movie writer or any kind of writer and failing. And I thought like, well, I'll just try something else. And so I started – I felt like I've always drawn. I always loved cartoons. I loved New Yorker cartoons and when I was a kid. And I thought I could – I'm not a gifted – I'm not a technically agile artist, but I have enough – I can draw well enough that like if someone like James Thurber – could be a cartoonist, I can be a cartoonist.
The kind of spare lines.
Yeah, something simple and crude.
To quote back to me.
But somebody, you know, he wasn't a trained artist. Let's put it that way. You know,
you're not either, are you?
No. So I started trying to be a cartoonist and failing at that, in addition to failing at all the other things, until finally, at the same time, years into it, I became a television writer and a cartoonist concurrently.
And did your doodles look like your cartoons? Your doodles as a kid? Would we recognize them as B.E.K.?
No. I think you would – they see – I was – when I cleared out some of the things from – or looked at some of the things in my father's house from my childhood, I saw – first off, I couldn't believe how bad they were. I said to my wife, like I called her. I was like, you can't believe how bad this stuff is. But they look – I think they looked more like Don Martin. Do you know who that is?
Yeah.
I loved Mad Magazine when
I
was a kid.
Yeah.
I think they were a little more Don Martin-ish. Although, I mean, maybe these are a little Don Martin. I don't know.
Oh, interesting. I mean, you were determined to get in The New Yorker, it sounds like. You had this almost like a ritual of 10 a week.
Yeah, I got a book out of the library. I got a book out of the library that said they had an art meeting once a week. You would send them a group of drawings, maybe 10. And I just started doing it, and I was religious about it. I never missed an art meeting, not one. Because I just was, this is it. This is who I am. They don't know it, but I know it, and they will come around.
You had that much confidence.
I didn't. Someone just – I spoke somewhere yesterday, and they said, you sound like you had so much confidence. And I'm telling you, and then and now, I do not have any confidence, but I do have belief. I believe in myself if there's a difference. To me, there's a difference because I feel very not confident.
Oh.
In all situations.
You believe in yourself.
But I do believe in myself.
All right.
Does that mean
other people don't believe in you?
I don't know. You know what I mean? Like, I don't feel confident. I've never felt confident that what, that I am, that I have something to say or that I, people are interested in what I have to say or that, but I do believe I have to say it. So that's the difference. It's like, this is, I don't care if you guys believe it. You know, I don't care if you guys want this, you're getting it.
I hear you. But it sounds like almost, I mean, did it become over time as you got, I mean, frankly, rejection letter after rejection letter, a kind of either a badge of honor or just, I'm going to break them down. I'm going to show them what I have.
No, I really don't remember it. That could be true, but in my memory of it, you know, and this is like 20 years ago, over. It became a very existential process. It was like it was as if they weren't even being looked at because I wasn't getting feedback or anything like that. And so it became like they were and are my journals, these cartoons.
Mm-hmm.
And so at a certain point it became, I'm sending it out to them because I believe in them. I'm not confident that they ever will, but I'm going to keep doing this because this is what I'm meant to be doing. And I just I always have a lot of faith. Not always, but, you know, when I'm doing something that feels right to me, I have a lot of faith that I'm supposed to be doing it. And I don't need and have never received that much positive reinforcement.
Really?
Yeah.
Really? Even from The New Yorker? I mean, being in there, I'm assuming, is reinforcement in and of itself? or could
yes,
be.
Yes, absolutely. But I'm just saying in general, before I, when I've been attempting things, before breaking through, I definitely have never, I always wanted in my 20s someone to say, like, you're meant to be doing this, you should be doing this, about anything I did, like whether it was writing or drawing, and no one ever said it.
Including your parents?
No, not at all. I mean, they felt like, oh, do something realistic. They were the opposite of that. They were against, they were about doing something to get insurance and a steady income and, you know, a secure life. So they were definitely not encouraging of go be creative.
So what did they think about their son in The New Yorker and also your work on TV, Seinfeld?
Well,
Six Feet Under.
They both, no, my mother wasn't around. My father liked Six Feet Under. They were proud. I think they were, and my mother was a big New Yorker person and loved The New Yorker. And so it was, you know, fun that I was a cartoonist. But then I think they had an attitude of it could all go away.
I mean, I feel like that was anxiety, the fear.
That was a big feeling in my house of like, if you're happy, don't be too happy. Otherwise, it's going to be taken away from you. I mean, that's Kenahura, you know,
it
Jewish
is.
Thing.
Sure, sure. I actually do want to play an episode from Seinfeld. It's called The Cartoon. Mm-hmm. You wrote this. And Elaine is, she's obsessing over the meaning of a cartoon in The New Yorker. And she's meeting with the magazine's editor, and she's going to have him explain it to her. Let's listen.
So, Jane Peterman wants to hire some of our cartoonists to illustrate your catalog.
Well, we're hoping that if perhaps the catalog is a little funnier, people won't be so quick to return the clothes. For example, I really do. Well, I love this one.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's a rather clever jab at interoffice politics, don't you think?
Why is it that the animals enjoy reading the email?
Well, Ms. Benes, cartoons are like gossamer, and one doesn't dissect gossamer.
Well, you don't have to dissect it. If you could just tell me why this is supposed to be funny.
Oh, it's merely a commentary on contemporary mores.
But what is the comment?
It's a slice of life.
No, it isn't.
A pun?
I don't think so.
Wolfstein?
That's not a word. You have no idea what this means, do you?
No.
No. Then why did you print it?
I like the kitty.
You know what? You people should be ashamed of yourselves. You know, you doodle a couple of bears at a cocktail party talking about the stock market. You think you're doing comedy.
Actually, that's not bad.
Oh, really? Yes. But, you know, I have others.
And that's a scene from Seinfeld written by our guest, B.E.K., called The Cartoon. So many ways that we can connect with that. Cartoons are like gossamer.
Mm-hmm.
Hearing your words back at you?
Sometimes. I don't actually ascribe to what the editor is saying in that scene. It's not my own personal belief.
Right.
Although I don't like to explain them. I was at somewhere last night where a man was explaining all the my cartoons actually, and like going, they reflect this, they do this. This is what happens in terms of our memory and juxtaposition. And I was just like, I was just exhausted by it. I just wanted to enjoy it.
Yeah.
You know, so I don't. Yeah, maybe I do feel that way. I'll reverse that. They are like gossamer. Yeah, totally.
Fair enough.
Yeah.
I was reading that for you. It sounds like it's a struggle to do your cartoons.
It is and it isn't. Everything, you know, it depends on the day and the moment. And, you know, I can sit down and something strikes me and it's hilarious and wonderful, not that anyone necessarily buys it. Or it's the opposite. I just sit. I think what you're referencing is I don't have ideas. Mm-hmm. Like, the way someone will say, like, I was driving and I saw this and I thought, like, this would be a wonderful cartoon. Or I was online at yoga and I heard two people saying this. And it's like, that's never happened to me. I mean, if I want a cartoon, I have to sit at my desk. I have to have my pad in front of me. Or if I'm on the set at Girls, because sometimes I do the reverse of just going. I don't sit at a – if I have to, you know, now that I – because of my other job, I don't always just sit at my – table. Sometimes I'll just go somewhere with a notebook and try and come up with cartoons. But I'll just go and say to my psyche, this is the time. This is what I'm doing. This is when I'm going within. So it's not like I'm out in the world observing things. Mm-hmm. And it's like, oh, I got a cartoon here. I got one there.
Just got to run home.
Yeah, exactly. So that's, yes. So it is a sort of struggle.
A question from Manya saying, how did you get your first gig in TV?
My first gig in TV was I was a writer for the 1991 Emmy Awards on the Fox Channel. And I got it because I had been an assistant to the head writer of that Emmy Awards that year. And for a few years prior to that, I had been his assistant. We were friends, you know. And he knew I was trying to be a writer, and he thought he would give me a break on it.
Wow.
So that was, the first few years I was very sporadic for me, and I would, you know, get jobs here and there, but also be doing cartoons.
We're almost out of time here.
Okay.
But, do you enjoy working with girls? I mean, being part of that show? I mean, it's a great show.
Couldn't love it more. Love the writers, love the actors, the crew. It's a great place to be.
Are you a producer on that?
Or yeah, executive producer.
And so you sort of manage production?
Yeah, I mean, there's a few executive producers, and there's basically I'm one of the writers who is also an executive producer, and we all work on the outline of the season and the structuring of the episodes. We, you know, each go off and write one, and then in terms of producing, you know, you're on the set, you're overseeing various things in pre-production. Such as locations,
sure.
Casting, that type of thing.
Well, Bruce Eric Kaplan, it's been a great pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us today, Radio Times.
Thank you.
You're very welcome. And his memoir is titled I Was a Child. He's speaking tonight at 7:30 at the Free Library of Philadelphia.
In case you want to hear me keep talking.
Exactly. Coming up next, we'll be talking about the end of the TV series Justified. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times. I'm Marty Motz-Cohen. I had the pleasure of interviewing crime writer Elmore Leonard a number of years ago, and when I heard that a TV series based on his story Fire in the Hole was going to be on FX, I tuned in and was hooked from the very beginning. Justified was about trigger-happy U.S. Deputy Marshal Raylan Givens, masterfully played by Timothy Oliphant, sent home to Harlan County, Kentucky, where he had to deal with his past, including his on-again, off-again nemesis Boyd Crowder, wonderfully played by Walton Goggins. The show featured eccentric and memorable characters, great writing and acting, complicated storylines, lots and lots of violence, and a dry, low-key humor. The series ended this week. Damon Darlin wrote about Justified for the New York Times. He's editor of The Upshot, and he joins us on Radio Times. And Damon Darlin, nice to have you with us. And I have to say, I always enjoyed reading your recaps of Justified when I read them in the New York Times. Are you going to miss this show?
I will, but I have to admit it was such a satisfying ending for the show that in a way I don't, because they wrapped up everything so beautifully, which is kind of a rarity these days in the series television.
And I was kind of vamping there for a bit, and some of what I read about Justified is it didn't have a large audience, you know, the kind of large audience you might associate it with, say, The Sopranos or shows like that. Why do you think that was?
I suspect that part of it is that it's a show, because it's set in a rural area with, you know, these country figures, Western motifs, that it probably didn't quite connect with the coastal audience that is where the media attention builds that can then build an audience. The truth is the New York Times did not start recapping this show until its final season, even though I was a fan of it from the season one and been advocating it for a while.
they finally let you do it. And let me tell you how much I appreciate that. Just picking up on what you said, as you said, there are all these kind of stereotypes about places like Harlan County, Kentucky. But what I thought was so great about the show is how complex the characters were and how much they avoided those stereotypes, even though, you know, there were a lot of characters who lived in this particular part of Eastern Kentucky.
Yeah, I mean, some of the characters were idiots, but a lot of them were, you know, as the main criminal ones were crafty, intelligent, But they all had dignity, you know, and this is something that is sometimes lost on these shows that have rural figures, is that, you know, they're there for mockery, and none of these characters were, you know, set up that way to be mocked. They were fascinating, interesting people.
Well, and Raylan Givens, as I said, played by Timothy Oliphant, a complicated character himself. I was reading that I think over these seasons, he's something like killed almost 20 people in real life.
He killed 20.
He did kill 20.
As of the finale, in line of duty, 20 people.
Yeah, and someone like that, I think, probably in real life would be behind bars and not out there, you know, doing his job.
Yeah, or probably a mall cop somewhere.
But what do you think Timothy Oliphant brought to this character?
Well, one, I mean, he was, you know, very appealing. You know, and
very good looking, you know, we should say, right?
Good looking, you know, it's kind of like the James Bond aphorism of, you know, the men want to be him and the women want to be with him. You know, it was that kind of character. But, you know, he's also a wonderful actor, just, you know, little hints and smiles conveyed, you know, so much more than, you know, a lot of actors could portray. But he also played well, you know, an ensemble cast. He was just good at playing off of everybody from, you know, teenagers to, you know, the psycho killers that he was up against.
He had this particular kind of walk, but he really had to, it wasn't the walk that John Wayne had, because he's kind of pigeon-toed. So he had a really interesting way of walking, I thought.
He did, and also the posing, the bent knee pose that he and also that Walter Goggins did too. That you know, it was almost effeminate in a way, but yet, you know, they pull it off.
Would you say he and Boyd Crowder, his, you know, they grew up together, they became kind of arch enemies, but there was a kind of a bromance going on there?
There was, but I always thought that it was more one-sided, that, you know, Boyd Crowder kind of looked up and maybe had more affection for Raylan, and Raylan just seemed to have contempt for Boyd Crowder. I mean, in disgust at times. You know, he wanted to kill that guy very badly, you know, right up to that last moment when he chose not to.
Well, and I think we can get beyond spoiler alert because it already aired. And I think there was this sort of big buildup. Is he gonna shoot Boyd Crowder? Sort of like a, you know, shoot down that you might see in the West. And he does resist.
Yeah.
And you found that satisfying? He did the right thing?
Yeah, I mean, this show was about codes, you know, you mentioned earlier about the Western that is, you know, it's a blend of a Western with a cop show, but, you know, and this is a part of the Western theme, is that, you know, that Raylan Givens lived by a code, and that was, you know, the other guy has to draw first. He has to, you know, he can provoke them. He's very good at doing that, provoking these criminals time after time to do this stupid thing. But he always warns them. He says he's going to win. He's going to kill you. But there is a basic code, and he lived by that. And in fact, not even the criminal characters do too. And the awful scene where in the mobile home where the Catherine Hale is killed. You know, it revolves around a code, but a misunderstood kind of code. So
indeed,
it plays with that theme throughout the show, and it's wonderful.
Well, and so many characters and so many great names, including, you know, Wynn Duffy, Mr. Limehouse, Dewey Crow. You know, I don't know. There's something about the names that they came up, which were just so reflective of who the people were.
Yeah. And a lot of that is Elmore Leonard. You know, right. Some of those characters showed up in the stories that he did on Raylan Givens. There were you know, four or five of these, some of them just, you know, short stories. But
yeah.
There were some of the stuff is laid out there.
Let me see what Tony from Mount Airy in Philadelphia has to say. Tony, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi.
Hi there.
My whole family just loved Justified. We just ate it up. And I was so surprised to find that so many people didn't watch it like you did.
Yeah.
I was just struck by it. And, you know, that whole code of everything being justified, what you were just talking about, that's why he didn't shoot him, because it wasn't justified at that moment. I think that they just stuck to Elmore Leonard's beauty in writing. It was just wonderful. I had one negative response, and that was, Raylan, Black Cat was too small. And I really didn't like the way that hat looked on him, you know?
I know exactly what you're talking about. And to our listeners, Raylan was known for wearing a hat and wearing it in a certain kind of way, and there's a shootout at the end where he does actually kill this pretty menacing guy named Boone and ends up wearing Boone's hat. Let me ask Damon Darling what he thought about that.
It struck me as odd, like that someone would want to wear a hat that that a criminal wore and B, it's someone that he killed. There was an interview that we did at the Times that one of our reviewers had sat down with Tim Oliphant and did an interview with him. And he said that the problem with the hat was that Elmer Leonard never liked that cowboy
hat. That's right.
And throughout the series, they've mocked it. They've thought about getting rid of it. And this was kind of a homage to Leonard that they finally got a hat that was more appropriate to the character that was written by Leonard in the in Pronto, the first book that he's introduced in.
Tony, thanks for the call. We've got Steve now from Hightstown, New Jersey, joining us on Radio Times. Hi, Steve. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. Actually, I just started listening to you yesterday. I heard you were going to talk about this, and this is one of my favorite shows.
Oh, that's great.
Poor Mikey. Yeah, I was very satisfied with the end. I always get nervous when a show is going to end because the finales have typically been a letdown, but this was phenomenal. It really tied everything up. I was a little disappointed with the way it worked out with his wife because they were leading up to something different. But the only thing they didn't really mention was if Bob was okay at the end.
Oh, if Bob, yeah.
Yeah, Bob. You know, and the other, they didn't play out Loretta. I was kind of curious what, you know, I kind of suspect where, and I think everybody in the audience did too, where she was headed. But I would love to have seen just a little bit more of her.
Well, Steve, thanks for the call to Radio Times. And Loretta's this young girl, when we first meet her, young woman who's kind of taken under Raylan's wing, and she, you know, she's taken on these big drug dealers. She's kind of fearless. We don't know what happens to her, but we know there's something like $10 million in those woods somewhere. What do you think happens to her, Damon?
Well, the show definitely wants us to believe that Wynn Duffy has the money. Ava suggests that she never got any of it or very much of it. Because she seems to be living a very simple life, but
right. But you can't always believe everything she says, though. You know,
that's very true. And you know, and if she's smart enough to know she's got to avoid attention, she's not going to live high on the hog and live, you know, have $5 million. And I want to believe the money's still up there in the hills. The story can live on in my mind that way.
You know, speaking of Loretta, there is a side to Raylan. We saw this in the last episode where you see him with his daughter, who looks like she's maybe 4 or 5 years old, and, you know, eating ice cream cones together on a playground. So it looks like he's a good dad who loves his daughter. He loves Loretta, the young crow boy that he kind of takes under his wing. You can see that Raylan has this really soft spot in his heart for children.
Yeah, I mean, he is... he appears to be a good father and wants to be a good father, considering that he had a horrific one, just a monstrous father. That, you know, that's life affirming. You know, it makes you like this character even more.
Do you think Art, who was his boss, was Raylan's good father? To be very Freudian here.
Oh, most definitely. Yeah, you see that a lot. You know, and that's another way that this show ended up very nicely. You see the two of them, you know, having a glass of good bourbon there at the end. That was a nice touch, too. Right. Something, very father-son relationship there.
Indeed. We have a Facebook comment from Dick. I should say Dick Pullman, who's been a guest on Radio Times, does a blog here at WHYY. He says, I miss them already. Ava's oral Southern sing-song, Wynn's cockroach survival instincts, Art's trenchant put-downs, Raylan's insouciance, Raylan's presence, Raylan's everything. And I think that kind of summarizes the kind
you
of
have it. Yes.
Kind of summarizes everything. Are you I'd be curious about the kind of response that you got to your weekly recaps.
It started out a little slow because I don't think the Times audience was, as we said earlier, kind of into it. But, you know, by the end, it was I got a very good response to it. That people were, I think, really getting into it. And, you know, the wonderful thing about television nowadays is you can go back and binge watch this whole thing. You know, now if you finally, you know, seen the reaction, you said, hey, I got to start over.
Check
and
it out.
I'll watch these things over 2 or 3 weekends and get all 6 episodes. You can do it.
Let me read another. There we go. And actually, let me read just another, a quick Facebook comment from Anne, who says, so well written and cast. It was brilliant to bring in Sam Elliott and Mary Steenburgen as bad guys in the final season. She says, though I still miss Megs.
Oh, she was, you know, she won an Emmy for it. So she got her deserved credit. But she's wonderful. I saw that she's back on The Americans.
Yes.
Last night they had her. So it's... she's a wonderful actress.
So we're almost out of time here, but so it was just you were such a fan of the show, and you worked on the people at the Times to say, let me do the recaps?
Yeah, that's basically what I, you know, would just kept asking. And luckily I had a very wise editor who said, yes, please do it for us.
Well, as I said, I enjoyed reading them, and I thank you so much, Damon Darlin, for joining us today in this portion of Radio Times.
Well, it was great fun. I wish I could do it forever.
Yeah. You and me both. And he did write about Justified for the New York Times, where he is editor of The Upshot. Adam Staniszewski, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, and the show is produced by Susan Greenbaum, Debbie Bilder, Emily Bryant, and John Ahrens, with help this week from Quinn Libson. I'm Marty Moscoane, and we do want to close things out with the theme music from Justified, and let's give it a listen.
On this lonely road, trying to make it home, doing it by my lonesome, pissed off, lonesome song. I'm fighting for my soul. Son, prepared to kill, son. A paradox of pain.